Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the Chills at Will podcast. The last 3 episodes dealt with minimalism and simply stunning lines. This episode, not so much on the minimalism. We're going lavish and over the top, and it is only fitting that we start the episode with Master P's Make 'em Say If you can name a more bananas music video, or at the very least, another video where solid gold military tanks are roaming over the basketball court, while many of the 20 plus players on the court unleash ferocious dunks, while Shaq and cheerleaders and the No Limit Army and even the ref bounce and rap along with the song, then I'll bow down to your knowledge. There is a school of writing that impugns the artistic merit of so-called purple prose. In literary criticism, purple prose is text that is so extravagant, ornate, or flowery as to break the flow and draw excessive attention to itself. The writing today that we're going to focus on manages to sidestep the potholes of sugary sweet, ostentatious, and hackneyed, surviving to walk straight and proud and carrying its immoderation as a badge of honor. I had Mario Puzo in mind right away and wanting to do an episode about lavish and over-the-top descriptions. His writing has thrilled me for years with his bold portrayals of scenes, characters, and blunt dialogue. And based on the success of The Godfather alone, it's abundantly clear that he's incredibly talented at crafting a storyline that enthused the masses. Puzo may not fit the bill as a writer's writer, one universally accepted as a master craftsman, but he, in fact, was not just commercially successful, but critically successful, especially early in his career. The article in the Los Angeles Times that marked his death in 1999 said, quote, "Puzo never pretended that The Godfather was great literature. He wrote it because he needed the money. His first novel, The Dark Arena, set in occupied Germany and published in 1955, was a critical success but a commercial flop. Puzo then spent 9 years crafting perhaps his finest work, The Fortunate Pilgrim, which is an autobiographical chronicle of Italian immigrant life in New York. And again, he received critical acclaim. And again, the book did not make money. There was a minor mafia character in that book that, at his publisher's suggestion, became the genesis of a mafia novel. His attorney and friend of 25 years, Bert Field, said, he had written artistic novels enough. He was now going to write a commercial novel. And he wasn't ashamed of it. He had paid his dues, and now he was going to make some money. So he sat down and turned out The Godfather." End of quote. In 1984, Puzo published The Sicilian, historical fiction which took many liberties in weaving the story of real-life Sicilian bandit Turi Giuliano with the story of the exiled Michael Corleone, as seen in Godfather Part 1. You may remember Michael killed Salazzo and the cop, the crooked cop in the restaurant scene, of course, and was exiled to Sicily. So that is where supposedly real-life Turi Giuliano meets up with Michael Corleone. And man, does Puzo hook you with this storyline. The rich language of both narrator and characters, and the energetic descriptions of the contagious action. My brother and I had this silly ritual on Easter where one of us would quote the book saying, "Christ is risen," as Puzo writes that this was the traditional Easter morning greeting of the Sicilian peasant, and that Turi Giuliano, quote, responded with the equally traditional, "Blessed be his name," unquote. Equally traditional. We loved it. But, what does that even mean? How is something equally traditional? How are two things equally traditional? Literally 100% equally traditional? Some of Puzo's family came from Naples, perhaps the most Italian of Italian cities. Probably what a lot of us think of as Italian and extremis is Neapolitan. The talking excitedly with the hands, pizza, pasta with marinara, the operatic daily operations or interactions among the extroverted and passionate. When I traveled to Naples in 2009, I felt like I was on the Truman Show. and the people were putting on the show just for my benefit. The city was in the middle of yet another trash crisis, a year removed from the almost annual strike by waste management workers. And the streets were laden with trash, just nakedly laid in the middle of the streets, ignored at the side of the road. I was awakened by the fish salesman bellowing, "Pesci freschi, pesci freschi." My boat ride to the islands off the coast were filled with bickering and lovey-dovey young couples alternately kissing and accusing, as I can only guess since my Italian is fairly weak. These were just some of the incredibly passionate and incredibly operatic scenes that I witnessed while in Naples. And the drivers over there, Santa Cleopatra. If you're a pedestrian deciding whether or not to cross, you better go. If you don't go within a millisecond of making your decision, then those scooters and those Fiats are going to keep going. In Naples, indecision is for the weak. So let's say that the riders featured today, Mario Puzo, who's literally Neapolitan, the Italian-American and originator of new journalism, Gay Talese, and Irish writer Niall Williams, let's say that they are the Naples of writers. Bold, innovative, tough, and not spare with their language. Puzo's The Sicilian is full of flowery descriptions, often heavy with adjectives and bold diction, with dialogue and in-your-face sentences that bring the chills. The book starts off with a flowing description of the sights that accompany Michael Corleone's arrival in Palermo via boat, the natural and personal descriptions full-throated and strongly visual. On page 4 of The Sicilian, Puzo empties the tool belt, writing, and I quote, "Palermo rested in the bottom of a bowl created by an extinct volcano, overwhelmed by mountains on three sides, and escaping into the dazzling blue of the Mediterranean Sea on the fourth side. The city shimmered in the golden rays of the Sicilian noontime sun. Veins of red light struck the earth, as if reflecting the blood shed on the soil of Sicily for countless centuries. The gold rays bathed stately marble columns of Greek temples, spidery Muslim turrets, the fiercely intricate facades of Spanish cathedrals. On a far hillside frowned the battlements of an ancient Norman castle, all left by diverse and cruel armies that had ruled Sicily since before Christ was born. Beyond the castle walls, cone-shaped mountains held the slightly effeminate city of Palermo in a strangler's embrace, as if both were sinking gracefully to their knees, a cord pulling tightly around the city's neck. Far above, countless tiny red hawks darted across the brilliant blue sky." End quote. My initial thoughts, dang. Puzo so self-assuredly throws in a well-placed semicolon to break up what otherwise might come off as rambling sentences. And he's not afraid to throw in a short sentence that might not even meet the standard definition of a subject and predicate-laden sentence. The verbs like shimmered and bathed, and even the personification of the battlements of an ancient Norman castle frowning, ramp up the passage's intensity and set the tone for the almost operatic last sentences. In finishing the paragraph, Puzo describes the, quote, "slightly effeminate city of Palermo," end quote. On one hand, what? How is a city effeminate? A good friend of mine who's just as much of a fan of Puzo, but is also, you know, with his eyes wide open, we often laugh about that part and just, what does he mean by that? Isn't that going a little bit too far? On the other hand, what a cool phrase. Puzo wasn't one for half-stepping and timid description, that's for sure. The brilliant blue sky, the gold rays bathing, the physical manifestation of the omnipresent diverse history of Sicily and its many invaders, all these add to the power of Puzo's writing. Brilliant blue sky, gold rays bathing. Thrilling. And the kind of writing that makes a 408-page book a pleasure to read. Later in the novel, Turi Giuliano hijacks a truck to get the foodstuffs on it, and he finds out that the truck is owned by an old man named Zu Peppino, harmless and respected in the area for his humility. When Turi proposes a plan where both he and Zu Peppino will benefit, the old man says, "Turi Giuliano, you were always a fine, brave young lad. Good-hearted, sensible, generous, and sympathetic. You have not changed since you became a man." Giuliano remembered that Zu Peppino was one of those old-school Sicilians given to flowery speech. "Count on my help in this and all other things. Give my regards to your father, who should be proud to have such a son." So I'm not sure that I introduced the quote, but of course it starts with Turi Giuliano being spoken by Zu Peppino. And, end quote, "Give my regards to your father, who should be proud to have such a son." Now, this is pretty meta. Flowery speech used to describe a man using flowery speech. Perfect for today's episode. Puzo's audacious writing does wonders for characterization. For example, the biggest mafia boss of the book, the deliciously named Don Croce Malo, his name a contrast in terms, is introduced in this way, and I quote, "Don Croce Malo was born in the village of Villaba, a little mud hole he was to make prosperous and famous all through Sicily. It was not ironic, to Sicilians, that he sprang from a religious family who groomed him for priesthood in the Holy Catholic Church, that his first name had originally been Crocefisso, a religious name given only by the most pious parents. Indeed, as a slender youth, he was forced to play the part of Christ in those religious plays put on in celebration of Holy Easter, and he was acclaimed for his marvelous air of piety." End quote. The man whose name means bad cross, playing Christ in plays as a kid, complete with a pious air, coming from a mud hole, and with his most holy of names, originally which would have been the crucifix, surprising no one, or at least no Sicilian, with his foray into being a famous mafioso, Puzo's writing may not be avant-garde or postmodern or post-postmodern, but man, is it interesting to read. Our second writer today is Gay Talese. Born Gaetano Talese to southern Italian immigrants, he's often held up as one of the originators of New Journalism, which the New Republic called a movement in the 1960s in which writers like Truman Capote, Norman Mailer, Tom Wolfe, and Joan Didion brought the techniques of fiction to reporting. Meaning, the new journalism is a little bit more Hunter S. Thompson and a little less pure objectivity than previous journalism. Talese has for sure brought controversy, as his style of writing has, for some people, unethically combined fact and fiction. Perhaps Talese's most famous piece is Frank Sinatra Has a Cold, which is a 1966 Esquire magazine article. Now, I come from a mostly Italian-American family, and even my non-Italian family members are huge Frank Sinatra fans. In the Italian-American family, there is the appropriate hierarchy of God, family, and Frank, with some agnostics appropriately throwing Dino into the mix. So please excuse me if I feel justified in referring to Frank Sinatra going forward as simply Frank. The Esquire magazine article examined a Frank Sinatra who was seeing his star dim significantly, or who was, at the very least, at a major crossroads in his life and career. Think Johnny Fontaine wailing into his hands right before getting slapped by Vito Corleone. Let me dip you immediately into the waters of Talese's prose. And I quote, "Frank Sinatra, holding a glass of bourbon in one hand and a cigarette in the other, stood in a dark corner of the bar between two attractive but fading blondes who sat waiting for him to say something. But he said nothing. He had been silent during much of the evening, except now in this private club in Beverly Hills, he seemed even more distant, staring out through the smoke and semi-darkness into a large room beyond the bar where dozens of young couples sat huddled around small tables or twisted in the center of the floor to the clamorous clang of folk rock music blaring from the stereo. The two blondes knew, as did Sinatra's four male friends who stood nearby, that it was a bad idea to force conversation upon him when he was in this mood of sullen silence, a mood that had hardly been uncommon during this first week of November, a month before his 50th birthday. End quote. What a sense of foreboding that Talese crafts here, with his illustration of the sullen silence that emanates from Frank and invades the room. And yes, it's a little on the nose, a little purple in his prose maybe, when I talk about this phrase, but who cares? These attractive but fading blondes, who are mirrors of Frank's career trajectory. There's something, too, about this occasion being so closed, so tight-knit, so members-only, with Talese a forgotten-about fly on the wall, telling the story intimately, but a bit dispassionately. We know that these six attendants to the king have seen this Frank before, have weathered his foul moods before, and that they are seriously sensitive to his fluctuations. Talese writes that this ill humor had hardly been uncommon as Frank's 50th birthday approached. I love the phrasing of the idea of hardly been uncommon. He could have said had been common, but there's something so clever, so skillful about hardly been uncommon. Talese tells us that this is Frank's private club, a subtle way of reminding us that this isn't Hollywood Frank. This isn't movie actor Frank, teeny bopper, Bobby Soxer Frank, or even Rat Pack Frank. This is the Frank who drinks hard, emotes hard, and even gets sick hard. As we know from the title and later explanation that Frank's cold has burdened his mood and his famous and singular voice. What a unique way in which Talese indirectly characterizes Frank, via the unnamed couple and friends who hover around his orb while keeping their social distancing. This is a place where Frank is the party within the party, and those on the guest list tiptoe around its star. Let's not forget about the Irishman. Our third chill-inducing passage comes from Niall Williams, the prodigious storyteller with a gift of gab keen to a fine point. At times, the Irish-born Williams may toe the line leading to saccharine, but in the end, his writing is lavish in detail. Keen on personality and uber-focused and centralized in documenting and creating nostalgia. The Amazon.com page for his 2019 novel, This Is Happiness, features the following quote prominently. You don't see rain stop, but you sense it. You sense something has changed in the frequency you've been living, and you hear the quietness you thought was silence get quieter still, and you raise your head so your eyes can make sense of what your ears have already told you, which at first is only, something has changed. The beginning of this passage is in italics, and the last three words in regular font. You know, it's often the opposite, where the part to be highlighted is in italics. But those last three words being regular font set themselves apart, and they highlight the power and prominence of the change that Williams writes about. My favorite part of this passage is, quote, you hear the quietness you thought was silence get quieter still, end quote. This is my favorite part for no other major reason than it just rings true, and that Williams is able to put words to something so slippery. The great writer and teacher of writers, Anne Lamott, writes in her touchstone book, Bird by Bird, of the importance of a successful writer fighting fatigue and writer's block and incapacitating anxiety by focusing on short assignments. She writes, quote, I go back to trying to breathe slowly and calmly, and I finally notice the 1-inch picture frame that I put on my desk to remind me of short assignments. It reminds me that all I have to do is write down as much as I can see through a 1-inch picture frame. This is all I have to bite off for the time being. All I'm going to do right now, for example, is write that one paragraph that sets the story in my hometown in the late 50s when the trains were still running. I'm going to paint a picture of it in words on my word processor. Or all I'm going to do is describe the main character the very first time we meet her, when she first walks out the front door and onto the porch. I'm not even going to describe the expression on her face when she first notices the blind dog sitting behind the wheel of her car. Just what I can see through the 1-inch picture frame. Just one paragraph describing this woman in the town where I grew up, the first time we encounter her. Man, that passage from Lamont should seriously get its own episode. The passage from Williams I will analyze is a prime example of that 1-inch picture frame. As Williams' intimate, warm, and targeted writing is truly exemplary model of that overused phrase, which is a slice of life. I read here directly from Williams. The pubs that followed those have folded into the night and lost their names. In many there was music, all of it played by suited figures, earnest and excellent and entirely absent in vanity or showmanship. It was a mystery to me how, before they took up their instruments, you could not tell the musicians from the audience. They looked like farmers, grounded ground men, shy and unshowy, smoking cigarettes and hunkered silent or small-talking over pints, with no evidence at all of their gift. They had no apparent inclination to take the instrument cases out of where they were stacked in the windowsill until they did. And when they did, the air was changed. There's no other way to say it. The smoky, dark corner of a dingy pub forgot that it was a nowhere. It became a locus, a center, and we became a company, focused around tables where, behind abandoned butts smoking in ashtrays and pint glasses paused amid tide, two fiddles, a flute, and a concertina made time stretch, so it was now and back, across the ages in the same moment. End quote. After first picturing this somber setting in which Will Ferrell's character from the movie The Other Guys sings startlingly sad and tragic dirges filled with, as he says, rich history and the Irish pub tradition. And this is such an underrated scene, by the way. After picturing that Will Ferrell scene, I hone in on Williams' descriptive skill. The idea of these long-forgotten pubs that have, quote, lost their names, the clever, backhanded description of the humble and businesslike musicians as, quote, absent in vanity or showmanship, or the surprise in store for the narrator who cannot distinguish the musicians from the crowd until instruments are picked up. The way in which these talented artists are bereft of style but singular focus on substance. Or the way in which Williams' narrator paints a picture of men who are simultaneously effortless and laborious in their craft. All of this creates a scene, a specific scene, that can only be inhabited by these men at this time. Williams' lavish description leads up to a change in the air, a pub, quote, forgetting that it was a nowhere. A pub forgetting that it was a nowhere. Williams describes the glasses that stop clinking, and the narrator so beautifully thrills with the following. Quote, two fiddles, a flute, and a concertina made time stretch, so it was now and back across the ages in the same moment. End quote. I imagine myself trying to imitate the writing style of Williams, and I see and hear a stilted, overwrought, and extremely cheesy piece. But this aforementioned passage is reason one of many. while Niall Williams is drowning in literary awards, while I can count on one hand my published pieces. Thank you to my friend Eric for recommending Niall Williams. It's really cool to share, you know, something that's very, very modern, very up to date. Again, this book was published in 2019. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Chills at Will the Chills at Will podcast. This is Happiness by Niall Williams, which I just described. Again, is a 2019 novel. The music was from the instrumental version and album version of Master P's Make 'Em Say from 1997's Ghetto D on No Limit Records. And yeah, please check out the video. It's so over the top. The clip of You Can Act Like a Man was, of course, from 1972's The Godfather Part 1 from Paramount Pictures. Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird, Some Instructions on Writing in Life was published in 1994 by Pantheon Books. In this episode's show notes, I've added a link to the Naples poem I wrote about my time spent there in 2009. The poem was called Just Visiting. Oh, and pardon me, I've forgotten, of course, to mention, it was, again, a 1966 Esquire magazine article called Frank Sinatra Has a Cold. And that's the Gay Talese piece. Thank you again for listening to this episode of the Chills at Will podcast. You can find me, Pete Real, on Facebook and Instagram at Chills at Will podcast, all one word. And on Twitter at Chills at Will P-O-1. That's the number one. That's all one word. Chills at Will P-O-1. Drop me a line, comment on a post. In whatever way it is, I look forward to hearing from you. I'd love for you to leave comments and feedback, and I'd love for you to subscribe at the podcast hub, which is chillsatwillpodcast6.podbean.com. I think I said it incorrectly last episode. chillsatwillpodcast6.podbean.com. Please pass on the podcast to anyone like-minded. I appreciate that support. Until then, my hope is that you continue to find that writing that gives you chills at will.